Hello. This podcast is available unedited and ad-free at patreon.com/HamiltonMorris. Each month, I release 3 to 4 new podcasts, and it was Patreon exclusive until recently. Many people contacted me and said they wanted me to figure out a way to make it freely available, and so I decided to accept sponsorship from a few of my friends. One of them is David Rentlin, the founder of a company called Lucy Nicotine. They make nicotine gum, nicotine pouches, nicotine lozenges, some of which are made with synthetic nicotine, which I think is pretty cool. Now, if you don't already use nicotine, I recommend that you don't start. It's habit forming. But if you already do use nicotine products, and especially if you smoke tobacco cigarettes, I can say that this is a cleaner product. And it's also a product that I use personally. If you go to lucy.co and use the code Hamilton, you get 20% off your purchase. This podcast is also brought to you by MindCure, a Canadian life sciences company producing synthetic ibogaine that is also engaged in psychedelic research with MDMA. They're doing some cool work, and I'm on their board of advisors. Lastly, this podcast is brought to you by Top Tree Herbs, an herbal tea company founded by my friend and pharmacopoeia producer, Soren Shade. This is not a traditional sponsorship in that I'm not receiving any money from them, but Soren is actually a producer on this podcast. They grow their own kratom domestically in Appalachia in a greenhouse, which is very beautiful, and they source leaves internationally, do third-party testing. I've been to the lab where they do the testing. They test for heavy metals and other adulterants, and it's ethically sourced in tea bag form. You can find their teas at toptreeherbs.com. Hello, everybody. Well, it's official. I have COVID now. I made it almost 2 years evading this viral infection, but I've got it. It's not so bad. Probably would be a lot worse if I weren't vaccinated. And so I am now on day 10, 11, of being home alone, isolating myself from other people, which has been a pretty good opportunity to listen to and edit interviews. So this interview is with a journalist named Peter Gorman. He is a very interesting person for a number of reasons. He's probably best known for being the journalist who broke the Phylomedusa bicolor skin secretion story to the world, writing about it for Omni magazine, and then having his reporting used to inspire the great scientist Vittorio Erspemer, discoverer of serotonin, in his own research on the various peptides that are present in these skin secretions. This is obviously a topic that I've found very interesting. In some sense, it was the beginning of my journalistic career, was interest in Phylomedusa bicolor. I remember getting a call from a producer named Santiago Stelli in 2008, and he said, "We're going to Brazil. We are filming a number of stories, and I've been reading some of your writing, and I'm wondering, do you know of any interesting drug-related things that we could do in the Brazilian Amazon?" And I said, it's the Amazon. There's a million interesting things that you could do. And he said, "Well, what do you think about ayahuasca?" And even then, I had this kind of, I was like, "Oh, ayahuasca, everyone knows about ayahuasca. That's not sufficiently exploratory. We should do something on the Phylomedusa bicolor skin secretions. That would be far more unusual." And he said, "Okay, all right, I'll look into it." And then called me back and said, "All right, okay, we're going to fly you to Brazil. Let's do it." And I was amazed. I went to Brazil, flew into Tabatinga. I was 21 years old and filmed this ridiculous story that would make me cringe to go back and look at it. So I will not go back and look at it. But it was probably one of the early videos, if not, I think there probably were other things that had been filmed before that of people receiving this traditional process of having their skin burned and having the toad secretion rubbed into their wounds. And despite it being, visually interesting and anthropologically interesting, I found the experiential effects of it less compelling. It's very powerful, make no mistake. Physically, it has a dramatic effect on your body. I felt this sort of vibration throughout my body, and although I didn't vomit or experience some of the very intense dimensions of the intoxication, I certainly recognized that it was a very real and powerful phenomenon. And then I sort of distanced myself from it because it didn't fall into any of the categories that I find most interesting. It wasn't really visionary or psychedelic in the strict sense of the word. And I started to have concerns about whether it was a good idea for lots of people to be doing it. I noticed shortly after you could buy what were called Cambo sticks from various online ethnobotanical retailers. And so I kind of dropped the subject and didn't talk about it very much afterward. I mean, I still meet people all the time whose bodies are covered in Gila Medusa bicolor scars, sometimes artistically arranged scars. I still have the scars on my arm from all those years ago, although they're quite mild and faded at this point. But the reason that most people know about this is because of Peter Gorman. He was the one that brought this to public attention. And for that reason, I think that this conversation is very interesting because we talk about journalistic responsibility, the complexity of reporting on these things, and what can happen when you talk about the practices of a remote indigenous group and when those practices become recognized by the world. And we also talk about reporting on drugs in general. I mean, Peter Gorman is emblematic of an era when the counterculture and the underground press were the only place to learn about these things outside of scientific articles that were virtually inaccessible to the average person. Now it's easy to look at something like High Times and scoff at it and think, you know, High Times, who would read that? That's not a serious publication. But if you go back and look at early issues of High Times, what you will find is that this was an amazing resource. It was one of the only publications that was routinely reporting on the atrocities of the war on drugs, changes in drug policy, advocating for drug reform, as well as producing a lot of artistically interesting writing. Peter Gorman reported on many important things. He was able to track down the radical environmentalist or eco-terrorist, depending on who you ask, David Foreman. He was one of the only people to write extensively about the Temple of the True Inner Light. He reported on all sorts of interesting drug issues that were not being talked about by anybody else. And then he became obsessed with exploring the Amazon and taking these trips. And I met him years ago at a conference and kind of followed his work casually in the time since. And I remember finding that he had contracted this life-threatening, flesh-eating bacterial infection that I think to this day has made it very difficult for him to walk. He's going on one final expedition to the Amazon and raising money for it. And I think this is a great opportunity to learn about all the contributions that an amateur can make. We also go into the meaning of the word amateur and how, you know, people will sometimes say, well, how do I get involved in this world? What do I do? And I think someone like Peter Gorman is a great example. Being interested, learning, investigating is how you get involved in this world. And I think that there's a lot that can be learned from his life's work. I hope you all enjoy this conversation.
Peter, I just started recording, Peter. Is that all right?
Yeah, I guess so. Okay.
How are you?
I'm all right. Is this Hamilton?
This is Hamilton, yes.
Hi, nice to sort of meet you.
We actually met maybe 12 years ago at an ayahuasca monologues performance in New York City. You might not remember, but it was quite a while ago. But I've followed your work for years and I admire many of your different projects. So it's great to talk with you.
Well, thanks very much. The thing that stands out for me was that they said if you talk, only 5 minutes, And it has to be very personal about ayahuasca, because we want it from your heart, not from what you think or blah, blah, blah. But I couldn't help it because Webster Hall, I mean, Mick Jagger got up there. And so I had to start with, I got the moves like Jagger, I got the moves like Jagger. And before they could cut me off and drag me off the stage, I cut into the ayahuasca part. But that was, it relaxed me in front of the audience, that's all.
I remember, yeah, it was a different time. Things were very different then.
People would have thought I was, I mean, half of them probably thought I was nuts.
So there's so many different things I want to ask you about, but my friend Soren mentioned that you had an ongoing correspondence with Vittorio Respamer. Is that correct?
We had for a couple of years. We were in touch maybe every 2 months.
That's pretty amazing.
You know, the Museum of Natural History in New York, to which I brought the first elemental Matses presents, broken arrows, a tooth necklace, a couple of throwaway baskets. I went there when I got a great idea to go there to find out, is my guide taking me to good tourist Indians or, you know, real indigenous people? And so I thought, well, if I offer this stuff to the museum, they'll either laugh me out of the museum or say, well, we already got tons of stuff from these people. So, but I thought that would clarify things for me in terms of spending thousands of dollars every year to go down with Moises again. And when I brought the stuff over, we set up a meeting. It took about a month to get a meeting together with the big shots. Bob Carneiro, who was head of South American Ethnology, and his assistant, Lila Williamson, who was building the whole of South American peoples at the time with the permanent collection of indigenous materials, both like stared at me open-eyed and said, this is my aruna. They kill everybody. How'd you get this stuff? And can we have it? I said, you can have anything you want, you know, but do me one favor. You got to write me a note that says I gave it to you so that my kids will know I wasn't just making it up. And then two, when I go down again, you have to give me an assignment of something to get that you could use for the, you know, for either for the archives or for the hall. And so that went on for years. Now, point of that story is that the introduction to the museum, it turns out that whatever was brought back, I mean, they had me write copious notes about where that broken arrow came from, who shot the arrow, what was the arrow made from, you know, how far out of camp, what camp and how far out of the camp was it used, what kind of animal killed, etc. So the same thing went when I discussed the frog sweat, which the museum, they later admitted, thought I was just making up. And the material that I wrote about where I got it and my experience with it, that found its way to Vittorio's hands. I mean, I think in that science world, the small science world of South American ethnology, somebody like the Museum of Natural History becomes a clearinghouse and lets people know we've got papers on this, arrows, new arrows here, a new kind of face paint over here. And, you know, so who's ever working on a PhD, if they need more material, there's new material to work with. So Vittorio got in touch with me through somebody, Tom Lytle, said, let's go over this. What went on? You did this? You had this stuff burning in your skin? Now, it turned out Vittorio had been working with frog secretions for several years. And mostly he was introduced in the Phytomedusa family. And then he was interested in not the poison arrow darts, but the anyway, another fairly large poisonous frog category. And he said, look, he later told me, he said, look, I've known all along, this material in the amphibian skin is completely loaded with bioactive proteins. or protein building blocks that should interact with the human body. But there's no experience of that anywhere on this damn planet. And I can't just start giving it to people because somebody might die or who knows what's going to happen. So when I brought out the story of me doing it, that began the relationship, which in its own way almost became an intimate friendship, in that he began to do some experiments that he discussed only with me. I don't believe he was discussing with anybody else, and I was sworn to secrecy. But he wanted somebody to hear, you know, for instance, let's make one up. I got 10 people, they're all dying of cancer tomorrow. And if you've seen people die of cancer, you know when they're at the last day, that's it, there's no going back. And he said, you know, so I gave it to 10, and three of them got an extra 2 weeks, and the other seven died. So, you know, that it would be that sort of thing that he could talk to me about through a third party interpreter. And then he used my story as the basis of a paper that appeared in 1992 in the pharmacological magazine Toxicon, in which he says, basically, you know, anthropologist Peter Gorman went down and did this frog sweat, had stuff burned into his skin by the Mayaruna, Mestizo Indians. And this is what he says happened to him. This paper will investigate whether any of that material that he, you know, whether or not what happened to Peter Gorman can be traced to the actual chemicals in the frog secretion. And pretty much one by one by one, everything I talked about, stomach and throwing up and pooping and sweating and heartbeat and the later clarity of it all, the strength in it, and everything, with one exception, which dealt with, I felt like as if tons of animals were getting, you know, running through me at one point. And he said, that one he can't explain. Either Gorman just made it up or it's his own personal, you know, but there's no chemical that would have caused that.
Just to be clear, Erspamer was doing experiments with Phyllomedusa secretions on people with cancer?
Hold on. No. He was working as general field investigator. He had people in South America sending him frog skins and some live frogs. Eventually I sent him a frog skin and also a live frog to work with. And I know I said he was doing some interesting work after it was discovered that he discovered that I had used it. Okay, and that I had not died. So he did a couple of small experiments. I made up entirely that cancer thing.
Do you remember what they were specifically? Since
yeah, but I'm not allowed to tell you. Come on.
He's long dead, though. You think he'd...
I know, but he's got kids. He's got family. And, you know, it was just interesting stuff. He was dealing with people who had all sorts of conditions. And you know, he would try to pinpoint on some of them, you know, utilize the medicine to pinpoint an area that he thought needed to be cleared up and might be able to be cleared up by the medicine. You know, please don't say anything about it. He killed cancer patients. I just made that up. That was my invention in the moment.
Oh, yeah. Well, because he didn't die until 1999, do you know if he was aware of the work that was done in the 80s with Bufo alvarius and 5-MeO-DMT?
I would say yes, but that was not of interest to him.
Really?
You know, he did not have, for instance, when you talk to Schultes, or when I would speak to Schultes now and then, even though Schultes was a button-down type of New Englander with, you know, he wore a vest in 90-degree weather, you know, under his jacket, there was a little bit of a smile with him when he said, do you realize, you know, like you're one of the three fathers of the hallucinogenic movement? And he would go, what'll do is Watson. Don't forget Watson. I know, I remember, of course, you got Tim Leary, crazy man. And but I, yes, I suppose I was. And he loved something about that, okay? And I don't think Sparmer, if he had that same slightly gleeful, oh my goodness, look at what this has opened up. I didn't get that feeling from him in talking to him ever. I thought he was just pretty. Now, again, we were dealing with translator and I didn't speak his language. I never got to shake his hand. So we're missing a lot of good elements that might have opened him up more.
Right. I mean, it's very, very interesting, the interplay of this research that was fundamentally chemistry. It didn't involve a lot of human psychopharmacology, but how that then led to these major advances in the way drugs are used. I mean, when Erspamer first published that 5-MeO-DMT was present in Buffo alvarius, I don't think he could have predicted that it would have created an international trade in the venom.
Was he the first who discovered that?
As far as I'm aware, he was the first, yes.
Okay, I did not realize that. That's, you know, this guy had so many feathers in his cap. And he was a little bit resentful that he hadn't won a Nobel. And that was when I say it was almost an intimate relationship. I don't know that he could complain to his superiors about not winning a Nobel. Huh. And he called me a botanist an archaeologist or anthropologist. And I just said, please don't. I'm an amateur. I don't have no letters after my name. I'm just an amateur. An amateur in the best sense of the word. The same way that Schultes tagged Wasson with the mushrooms, said, look, he was an amateur. He didn't study courses, but he studied more than people who knew those courses. So, you know, and I hope that I might not have been at the same level amateur as, Wasson, but I did, you know, made it clear to him that, you know, Vittorio, I'm not, you know, I wish you to show me that ahead of time. I would have taken that out because I don't want people coming back to me or to you saying that you didn't get the facts straight or that Peter's a liar. You know, either one of those sounded awful to me.
Right.
And in terms of, sorry, that was a side note.
Well, I think it's interesting because I agree. People call R. Gordon Wasson an amateur ethnomycologist, but the reality, of course, is there was no other kind of ethnomycologist. He created the field of ethnomycology. He coined the word. There's no professional ethnomycologist. He may have been an amateur mycologist, but even the word amateur, I think, is something that people often confuse. They think it means that you're bad at something as opposed to what it really means, which is that you're doing it out of love and personal interest as opposed to professional engagement.
Yeah, and that was, you know, but on the intimate level with this Palmer, you know, he let me know that he thought isolating serotonin in the stomach was so important. And I've been told and I've looked it up and everybody's either going along with a lie or it's true that Palmer ended up being a finalist for the Nobel for that. And then he thought the frog sweat was going to win him one. I mean, once he isolated those, you know, the first seven major, major peptides, dermaphin, deltaphin, and, you know, the painkillers and the blood-brain barrier, there's all sorts of kinins, the bradykinins that could jump the blood-brain barrier. But unusual and unique about the SAPO was that SAPO allowed its bradykinin, phytokinin it's called, allowed it to piggyback other things into the brain without hurting the protection around the brain. So like we deliver, you know, a cobalt treatment to brain cancer, but we blow a hole in your protective, in that little picket fence around the brain that's keeping the bad stuff out. So now the bad stuff gets in. So they might've got the cancer, but now you die of pneumonia or a common cold. Okay. So he really thought this was going to do it, and it didn't do it. I think he got fairly close, but it didn't do it. And he was, to say pissed off is being very nice. He would go into an Italian, elderly Italian, bum, 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 which included all sorts of bad names to the people who hadn't given him the award.
I mean, even the methods that were required for the initial isolation of serotonin were pretty extreme. I think it required the salivary glands of thousands of octopuses.
You know what? You're a scientist and I'm not. But I've heard some of this, but it's so far beyond my ken. And, you know, it's like, okay. How the frick did they come up with this stuff? How the heck? And that's about where I get lost and go into a dream state.
This is all just to say that, yeah, I agree. He did deserve the Nobel. It's one of the most important discoveries in the history of neuroscience, and it's amazing you didn't get one. And okay, and I'll ask one more time and then I'll drop it. Can you tell me anything about the experiments that he was doing that he didn't publish? Is that something you just don't want to go there?
Yeah, I, if we did it six months from now, I'll tell you what I'll do. I will go through the letters I've got from him and I will see if there's, you know, a few things that I could just tell you, and I'll be as straight and clear with you as I can.
Okay, yeah, I would love
if that. I don't see anything horrible, because people get very afraid, and I know these days, but you don't want to diminish somebody who in their field is doing something that makes sense. It doesn't necessarily make sense to a person outside the field. Now, one of the famous stories, horror stories of the whole world, was when the University of Pennsylvania had, I believe they're working with chimpanzees, and they were dropping stones on their head to see how much pressure, at which angle, the skull exploded. And they were doing like 70 or 100 monkeys a year, or, you know, chimpanzees a year. And I mean, you could look it up, and finally they kind of outlawed that in the country. That's not the same as somebody else who might need to use some rodents because they have a similar, there are similarities in our, you know, in our, the way our bodies are built, to see if a medicine is going to be efficacious and non-poisonous, or, you know, because before they put it on humans, they want to check it out. So both experiments are going to end up killing some animals. But one is going to get something out of it that might, okay, you can't quite justify killing rodents, but that's far different from, hey, man, like in my eighth year of dropping rocks on monkeys' heads, which is just awful and with no purpose.
Well, I imagine there was some purpose, you know, to characterize the effect of traumatic brain injuries, hoping it will have some relevance to human medicine. I mean, that's the problem with a lot of this stuff is when you pull it out of context, it looks terrible. I did an interview with a physician named Edward Domino. You might be familiar with him. He was the first person to give ketamine to a human being. And in the first administration of ketamine to a human, it was done to a prisoner, and it involved pain experiments that by today's medical standards would be considered totally unethical. Does that mean that Edward Domino is an abuser or an unethical practitioner of medicine? No, it means that he was practicing medicine in the 1960s in a time when the norms were completely different, and to criticize something that he did a half century ago by today's standards just isn't fair to him, because probably almost everyone practicing medicine at that time was guilty of similar or worse offenses of one kind or another. But I felt conflicted about talking about it publicly for the same reasons you described, because people tend to be very unsympathetic. We live in a very judgmental time where people tend to go out of their way to not understand where people are coming from, as opposed to making an effort to understand.
Good way to put it. Yeah.
But that all said, I'd love to know what the Erskine-Bamer experiments were.
And I promise, you know, starting this afternoon, I'll go through. Okay. I got a box, a small box, but it's letters from the people in the museum with Schultes, you know, with Wasson and McKenna. And it's just, they're kind of important to me.
Of course.
I managed to get these guys to give me a phone call, to write me a note. The first time I wrote Schultes to be able to get I needed an in, okay? And because I admired the guy for 30 years, but I had no in. Why would he, why am I bothering him? Hi, my name is Peter, and I'm like, I think you're cool. Okay, that's not going to work. So Wasson had died, and he had died, it was coming up on a year. And I said, you know, Dr. Schultes, I would really love, a year's passed since your good friend died. I would love to talk about your relationship and how you managed to give him, you know, the small statue of the mushroom, and which turned him on to going to, in Oaxaca.
Huautla?
Yeah. And so I said, and you know what? He wrote me back. He included in writing me back, he said, well, just call. But he included my letter, completely marked with a red pen.
Huh.
Just like a teacher, you know? As if it was never bothered me with a letter with 12 mistakes again.
That's pretty funny.
And yeah, I mean, those letters, I mean, they all... It wasn't just to get them and say, you know, I mean, I don't walk around saying, I got a letter from you, I got a letter. But to me, there is an indication some of these guys had wonderful senses of humor. Some of them had quirks. And you get that on the second letter or the third phone call, you know, where it is something reveals about themselves that you say, I would never have read that anywhere.
That's, yeah. And you also mentioned Thomas Lytle. I'm very interested, again, back to this sort of amateur idea, because during that era in the 1980s, especially, it felt like it was amateurs versus nobody else. There only really were amateur investigators at that time. And I think it was people like Thomas Lytle who had no academic credentials or affiliations who were kind of keeping the torch lit during the dark ages. I mean, could you tell me a little bit about your relationship with those underground researchers? I think you could also include people like Terence McKenna, of course, a far more high profile example, but somebody who's, you know, doing this research without academic institutional support and keeping the interest alive in a different way.
Well, these guys, I mean, Tom Lytle, I guess he had seen a couple of pieces of mine in High Times magazine. So he saw the ayahuasca piece that was probably the first national cover story on ayahuasca in 86. But Tom got in touch, and he had a friend named David Goldstein.
He's a friend of mine. I love him.
Oh, okay, because that guy's like the most brilliant researcher in the world.
Yeah, he's amazing.
I haven't seen him and talked to him in 30 years, but, you know, we did a few stories where I said, you know, Dave, I'll give you $500, do a little background research. And then Emma Effer would come back with, you know, 40 pages of material. You know, they were just the citations. Did I want to see the whole notes? And was like, holy mackerel, I only gave you $500, you know. But so David came over to my house. Tom came over to my house early on, I think in 91. One or the other or both were among a group of 10 or 12. Now we would use the word psychonaut, but I mean, 10 or 12 people that you're describing, you know, amateurs with a wonderful interest in the fields of altered realities, who did frog sweat in my house, in my kitchen. So it was a good group of time. I mean, Tom and I just became fast friends. I had a big interview done with him for High Times. He in turn did a big interview, the first big interview with Rick Doblin, before Rick Doblin had any letters after his name, when he was just beginning MAPS. And yeah, I mean, I think Tom, over the years, used two or three of my pieces about the indigenous Matses and Sapo and hunting magic. And I think, I hope I'm not out of line, I think he used two or three of my pieces in his PSNE, or right? Psychedelic Research, PRE, Psychedelic Research and Experimentation, or whatever. A book that he put out quarterly for several years. Unfortunately, he passed a couple of years ago, which was, I was saddened by that. And I went to look up David Goldstein and to see if he was still around. And I don't know what, maybe I quit it. I didn't do it long enough because I'm a journalist and an investigative reporter. And if I put enough time and energy into it, I would actually have an answer. I'm very glad you're telling me that he's a friend of yours, which kind of gives me hope that he's alive.
Yeah, not only is he alive, and he lives in an archive surrounded by thousands of boxes of photocopied scientific literature about psychedelics. He has things that nobody else has. He's given me scientific papers I have never seen anywhere else. I mean, he's really like, there's no one like him anymore. You know, now if you ask like a young scientist to do research on something, if it's not on the internet, they don't know about it. The world is the internet. There might be things that are referenced on the internet and then you have to find the physical copy, but if it's not referenced on the internet, it doesn't exist. So he's from this era pre-internet when everyone is collecting enormous amounts of research. He showed me things that you would never know existed because there's no reference to them on the internet. And specifically, this actually ties into the other thing that I wanted to talk with you about. He's given me quite a bit of literature on the Temple of the True Inner Light that doesn't exist anywhere outside of his archives. So I know that you did probably wrote the seminal piece about them. Do you want to talk about that at all?
Sure. I was kind of on a hot streak with High Times. It was fascinating story after fascinating story. And I'd done the ayahuasca one, then I did one about Sapo and Nunu, the snuff. I did one about Piti Piti. And I did a three-part piece on the Native American church. It took me a year to get invited, you know, as a journalist into a Native American ceremony by the Southern Utes. And then I found out about the Temple of the True Inner Light. And it was like, I have to look into this. And so I did. And it took 3, 4, 5, 6 months until they believed I was true enough soul that they could let me in. And the worst come to worst would be that I would say I had a very scary experience, but they thought I would be honest about it. And I think in the end, they actually loved the article. And I was quite surprised. I mean, this was a bunch of like long hairs down in the village, on the East Village, maybe Avenue 2nd Street and Avenue B, something like that.
East 9th Street.
Okay. And they had a little door on a floor level apartment, ground level apartment. And it had a pretty, pretty mushroom on it. And Andrew Grossman, the photographer for High Times, is quite famous, took a photo of me in front of that door. And I was just back from India, and I was skinny, and I had a beautiful leather jacket on. Felt like $1 million. Well, I did get in there, and I had these kids. They were true believers. It was sort of a cult. But on the other hand, they were making a living cleaning apartments, painting apartments for 3 or 4 buildings for a couple of different landlords down there. They were delivering food on bicycles. So they were, even though it could be perceived as a cult of sorts, they were absolutely anchored in reality in terms of, yeah, so we're janitors. You know, restaurant toilet backed up, we got to go. So I love that part of it. They were so down to earth. And I love the part that they had been using DMT. Now, this is pretty early on before very many people were using it, right? Starting in like, I don't know, 65, maybe 70. I wasn't much, I think it was earlier than that. Like, you know, I think it was pretty early on. That was their sacrament. Then that was by analog law made illegal by the feds. And so they talked to Schultes and said, you know, the medicine you make us, you won't make us anymore. He said, well, I can't. You know, it's now illegal for me to do that. So he came up with a new substance called DPT, which is just maybe one little molecule off from the DMT. And it was, you know, it was really a thumb in the nose by Schultes
Shulgin
to, you know, to the U.S. government, you know. And so I ended up doing the DPT because the other one had already been outlawed. So it was interesting and was brilliant, brilliant, you know, 15, 20 minutes. Or shall I say a brilliant five lifetimes in 15 or 20 minutes.
It's pretty remarkable. And do you remember about any of the people that you met when you were there? Like what kinds of characters were involved with that group?
Well, as I said, I mean, the primary thing that I came away with, number one, almost every time I met them was outside, like just sitting on a stool in front of the door. I was not allowed in, except for the one time I was doing the medicine. So I didn't get particularly close with any of them. Although I've been in touch with one guy, you know, for the last 30 years, period, maybe once a year, twice a year. As I say, they were true believers in the medicine as God. And that God was light and God was healing and God was everything good. And that's where the cultish thing comes in, because if you're not a true believer, then you obviously are someone who should be scorned. But they were also all working as a group of hippies. They worked as janitors in several tenements down there. They were delivering food and medicines from pharmacies and stuff on bicycles around, you know, and they were cleaning up restaurants at night, you know, like as porters when the restaurant closed down. And so at the same time, they were wrapped up in their belief system of the medicine as God. They were absolutely also wrapped up in, it's our job to work. If we don't work, we lose everything. And so, you know, no work is demeaning, all work is good. And I could tell you that they ate like whole grain bread that they made inside, because they gave me some. And they grew some mint, because that's what they put in the pipe to hold the medicine. And they thought it was important that they grow that themselves. There's only so much I could say, because I was only allowed inside one time.
You mentioned that you have remained in contact with one person. Can you tell me who that is?
Javier Soren, because I forget the guy's name all the time. But when Soren came to me a couple of years ago, his dad came to me and said, Soren's interested in this. What, can you give him some information? And I had to go look everybody up again, blah, blah, blah. And I thought, I think they're all dispersed by now. It might have been 2 or 3 years at that point. After a long time of occasional correspondence, it might have been a couple of years since I'd been in touch. And then I got an email back from this guy. And he's like, Peter, how are you? What's going on? Huh. You know, again, just plain old down to earth. Like, you know, yo, I've been busy. You've been busy? So it was very nice to reestablish that. But I'm going to tell you right now, I'm not going to remember his name this minute. But Soren will, because
Was it something like that?
Or maybe? It might have been, I think. I don't think that was the regular person. I think that was somebody that was occasionally in touch. I'd be curious now. I'd love to spend an afternoon with them. Just to see, because they'd be 60 years old now, you know. And that's a long way from being 27. Have they really kept their scruples? Have they maintained their belief system? Has the belief system been true to them?
They've maintained their belief system, I can tell you that much.
Yeah, but I'd like to see it personally.
Yeah.
You know, I would just like to see it. They were very, very closed. I don't know how I got so lucky. I mean, Schultes was not going to give people that much time. Shulgin and his wife spent 20 hours with me on the phone. And then we did a couple of conferences where, well, he was a big shot. I was a little shot on the sheet. But, you know, I got to spend a half an hour with him. Tim Leary, forget about the botanists that have spent time with me. It's like, what a delicious stew that these people, I don't know how I managed to get so lucky to get so many people that are fascinated in their fields to decide this guy's worth spending several hours with. You know, let's go have lunch. Let's have him bring him up to Boston. Have him sleep over. Let's this, let's that. It's like, wow. But boy, I sure feel lucky. I mean, just the people you're mentioning right now, when you talk about Ernst Farmer, and I mentioned Schultes, and there's Wasson, and there's Temple of the True Inner Light. It's like, who the heck? What joy there's been in being able to learn from these people.
Well, I think that there truly is a community of people that really, really care about this stuff. They're obsessed. And when they see that obsession in another person, they recognize and appreciate it. And that is, I mean, I've seen the same thing in my own life. I've been tremendously fortunate to have these great people give me the time of day. You know, when I look back at somebody like Alexander Shulgin, even responding to an email that I sent him when I was a freshman in college, it's amazing.
Yeah.
But I think that when somebody shows genuine passion, it shows, and people, you know, are receptive to it. I also think it's interesting that, you know, I think if you talk to a normal person about a publication like High Times, they have this sort of cartoonish version of it where they think of it as weed porn, right? Just, you know, close up macroscopic.
We certainly had some of that. We certainly had our share of, porn pot.
Yeah. I mean, especially in later years, I agree. But when you look at the early incarnation of High Times at the beginning, it was really a counterculture magazine that published interviews that wouldn't have happened anywhere else. You had a lot of brilliant people contributing, from William S. Burroughs to
Charles Bukowski was a regular for a couple of years.
Who was?
Charles Bukowski.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So it was, you know, all sorts of people, from fiction writers to scientists, were contributing. And not only was the work very good, you couldn't really find work like that anywhere else. Since you were a major contributor, could you tell me about what it was like being a drug-oriented journalist working at High Times during that era?
Well, here's the thing. I was not there early on. It started in, like, I think, 72, 73, and I came aboard in 86. And the first story I wrote was ayahuasca, and Steve Hager retitled it to Ayahuasca, Mind-Bending Drug of the Amazon, which I was totally embarrassed about, and I remain bitter about it being so callous and cold, you know, that you're just going to use this. It felt like ayahuasca was being used already. Now, I'll tell you, I mean, one of the things that to me was very major, although it's personal. So, I mean, pardon me, everybody. was that after I'd written three stories about the Amazon, two about the Amazon and one about a doctor in Lima who was a psychedelic plant doctor, who an amazing healer. It was a catalog of information on hallucinogens from Central and South America. Then I got a call from Steve Hager and the publisher, and said, come on in, let's meet, let's talk. So I went in for the first time, I met him, and they said, okay, here's the deal. Do you know Earth First? And I said, yeah. I read for the Earth First, paper journal now and then, and for the last couple of years on stories related to the Amazon. And they said, well, you know that they're on the FBI's most wanted list. And I said, uh-huh. They said, okay, so your job is to find Dave Foreman, the leader, who is the number one wanted man in the FBI in the United States. And I said, what? The guy's the most wanted man in the United States. Well, what do you mean, find him? Huh. Hello, Joey, you know Dave? And I spent two or three weeks at home, maybe 20 minutes a day, 30, which crossed my mind, like, what stupid. If they don't want me to write for them anymore, why didn't they just tell us, say, don't write for me, instead of giving me an impossible job? Well, then one day, like often happens, and I'm very lucky, the light bulb went off. And I said, let's go through every photo of him up till now. So I went to the Fiche in the New York Times. The New York Public Library. And I found Fiche was microfiche. Tiny versions on spools of newspapers and magazines and such. So you could read the whole magazine, in a piece of spool that would be less than a sewing machine bobbin. And I kept looking, and it was like, you know what? He is a big guy. And he is from the Midwest. And if he's big and from the Midwest, it means he played football in high school. And if he played football in high school, that means he still watches college football. Where do you watch college football? You go to a bar. So I said, well, we got South Dakota and we got Wyoming. And I tried to figure out which would be the easiest one. And I called the out to time because we get three numbers from the operator when he called, operator or 411. And I started with Wyoming and I said, can you give me the first three listings under bars? I don't want any, I don't want hotel bars. I want bars. And I got up to about 200 of them. And that was nearly the end of the state, maybe 249. And then I began calling four or five a day. And I was cold calling. And my talk was, hello, this is Peter Gorman. I'm a reporter for High Times Magazine. I'm trying to reach Dave Foreman. I don't know if you know Dave Foreman, but if you do, could you please pass along this number to him? And I would give him the number. And they would be like, well, what the heck? This whirlwind just came in here. And I would do five or 10 a day. And I kind of do about 100, just over half of the state. And I got a call one afternoon. Hello, is this Peter Gorman? Yeah, what can I do for you? Click. Day or two later. Hello, is this Peter Gorman? Click, click, click. Six or seven times it went down like that. And maybe the seventh or eighth time. Hello, is this Peter Gorman? Yes, it's Dave Foreman. What the fuck are you trying to do, reach me? What do you want? And so, at that point, I thought, I'm going to be a great investigative reporter. I just found the number one FBI guy, and they can't find him. So this is a sign from the heavens. So I worked for High Times magazine. They let me be an editor of a small section in Eyewitness News, which was the news of the drug war.
I love the Eyewitness.
I was never the guy who was going to write about growing I was never the guy going to compare, like, oh, this strain is a little better than this strain. This strain's flatter. This is a little more, lopsided to the body or lopsided to the brain. That was not me. What was me was how many guys were going to jail for fucking a little pot, and they're going for 20 years, 30 years, or for LSD. What about people that forfeiture came in about 88? It blew me away. Wait a minute. You got a 500-acre farm. The kids behind you throw five pot seeds in your farm, and 6 months later, the cops come and confiscate your entire farm and throw you on the street. You know, you don't even go out to that 80. You know what I mean? So the hard news of the drug war was really, really what got me. And so because I had that investigative, luck with Foreman, I mean, I kept using it. And I kept having more and more luck like that, where you just use your brain to the point where you ask the heavens and the heavens say, okay, here's a light bulb. Ting. And you're like, holy mackerel, I think there's an answer there. So on the one hand, there was a certain embarrassment because I would meet people in the business and some of them maybe knew some of my work. They didn't realize it was from High Times. Maybe they knew a New York Times piece from earlier than that or something else. And then suddenly, like, you're at High Times. Well, you just get stoned all day.
Ah.
I mean, that was the presumption. And so, in fact, I was still at High Times when I married and a woman that I met in Peru, and she had two young sons. And so we brought them to the States and we enrolled them in public school, and they started the DARE program then, which was when cops come into the room and tell kids, drugs are bad, don't do them. Drugs are bad, don't do them. Well, the program was a joke because all it did was make kids want to do drugs. Drugs are going to make you see things that aren't there. They're going to make you laugh and giggle throughout your dinner. Sounds good to me.
Huh.
So at the end of one DARE program, the guy holds up two copies of High Times and says, and if you know anybody who reads this magazine, you could just write their name on a piece of paper and put it in that box over there when you leave. And my son, Mark, but to his everlasting credit, stood up and said, that's my dad's magazine.
Uh-huh.
And he stood by it. The principal called me, the cop called me, his teacher called me. And I said, what do you want me to do? That's how I'm raised. I'm raised to be honest as you can be. You know, don't give anybody baloney. Don't hide behind anything. If you need to hide, then you might not be doing something you should be proud of. And nothing came of it. The cop really, even though he didn't like my position, he understood it. You know, the teacher in the end thought it was hilarious. And the principal just said, you just be careful. You know, if we end up having to go to your house and we find marijuana there, that's child endangerment. You know, so it was like, so I enjoyed once in a while doing a story that involved moving 50 or 100 pounds of pot somewhere from here to there, smuggling some pot across the Mexican border, or working with Keith in the reef in Morocco, and being with smugglers there. I loved that part of the dope scene. But is this strain a little bit better than that strain? It just really didn't fascinate me very much. I just liked, give me any dope you got, it's going to be good. It's always good dope.
I'm going to pause momentarily for an ad. This podcast is brought to you by Matcha Kari, matcha.com. This is Andrew Weil's Matcha Tea Company. Andrew Weil is one of the pioneers of the study of psychedelic drugs, and he now owns a matcha tea company that sells imported matcha that's tested for heavy metals. If you go to matcha.com, you can see the analysis of all of their teas. I drink it almost every day. It is delicious matcha. If you go to matcha.com and use the discount code Hamilton, you get 10% off any teas that you buy. Thank you, matcha.com.
Well, this makes me wonder, did you know Ron Rosenbaum?
Yeah, but not very well. I met him, but I did not know him.
Yeah, because he's very much that type, but he's someone I love very deeply. He saw it as a sort of creative catalyst, something to think about the qualitative effects of the cannabis. He was, a connoisseur, but I lean more toward your side of enjoying the excitement and drama of investigation. And also, I mean, you speak to another thing, this idea that if somebody is interested in drugs, it must be because they are a drug addict. If you work at High Times, you must get stoned all the time. I mean, this is something people say about my work. They say, oh, he makes documentaries about drugs, therefore he gets high for a living, or some version of that, or he must be a heroin addict because he's interested in chemistry. It's all very absurd, but it kind of shows how stigmatized the very idea of being interested in this subject is. And I think on another level, how important it was to do that work, because no one else was doing it. If you look at contemporary coverage of those same issues in the New York Times among people that would conventionally be considered serious journalists, they're not talking about the injustices of the war on drugs. They're basically promoting the same agenda as law enforcement. If somebody gets arrested in a drug bust, they don't frame it as unjust. They frame it as, just the order, the natural state of things in our country.
Yeah, you knew the consequences, so we don't need to feel sorry.
Right. And and I think that's why it was so important to have this counterculture. And then there's the other side where people would say, okay, well, for that reason, because it's so misunderstood, nobody should talk about it. How can you bring attention to these subjects? Because we live in a culture where nobody gets it. So it's better to hide. It's better to be silent. It's better to keep it all in the dark, because any publicity is bad publicity. And I also think that that perspective is false as well, because in order to progress as a culture, we need to be open. We need to be honest about these things. Otherwise, we'll never learn.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, also, I mean, at High Times, we pulled off making medical marijuana, like rebirthing it. Which led to the whole movement. Now, we were the reporters on it. We were not the activists, but we found the activists. We found the people getting the marijuana from the federal government, even though the program had been shut down, except for those six or seven people. But we went and spent time with those people and learned the value of it. The idea that this be kept away from people who could find great relief. One woman was Sister Somaya, who was a Black woman who'd been in the military. And she called me up once every few weeks, about 4 a.m. on a Saturday night, Friday night, wake me up, get on the phone, and she just hurled curses and curses and curses, slammed the phone down. It took me 10, 12, 15 phone calls to finally get a word in edgewise and say, what the hell are you doing? What do you want? She said, sickle cell anemia. You white people, you don't get it. So it turned out, she said, well, look, sickle cell, she said it very frantically, said sickle cell anemia is only in people of color. So white people don't concern themselves with it. She said, marijuana, the treatment for that is to go get methadone or morphine. And she said, that's why you got so many junkies who are middle-aged sitting on the front porches. They're U.S. government junkies. If those people could be allowed to smoke marijuana to relieve the pain, and the gist of the sickle cell was that instead of cells being round and just like moving freely up and down, the river of your blood, some of them would get hook-nosed, And so they would like bump into a bone and stick on it. And when enough of that clustered, it became impossible to move that joint. The joint was extremely painful. So the morphine and the methadone might have taken away the pain temporarily, but the marijuana was a vasodilator, opening up the bloodstream so that more blood could move throughly, which gave enough room to get sickle cells knocked out of place and you know, into the regular bloodstream and not giving you pain. So Sister Somaya, she brought that to the world through High Times. And an awful lot, I mean, that was one of one important element to get the Black community in, throughout the United States behind medical marijuana, because it was something that they understood they suffered and we didn't, or those of us who were not in that community didn't suffer it. So so we hadn't paid attention to it. And so, I mean, to me, what a thrill that I had to put up with all those annoying conversations to finally get to say, what are you screaming at me for? What am I doing wrong? You know, you got me on speed dial for every 2 or 3 weeks. So, yeah, I thought the magazine was quite important, despite the pot porn. And for the people who like the pot porn, that was fine. But, you know, half of our readers, a third of our readers, really were interested in the laws because they were either facing the laws, were going to face the laws, or were wondering what could really happen to me. And so we really maintained that. The whole office did, so that information would be available for people. And a large chunk of our audience was people over 35, over 40, who I don't know how much they cared about looking at the pot, but they really did love reading investigative pieces.
Yeah.
Or pieces about cultures, you know, the Rastafarians or different cultures around the world.
Oh, yeah.
Dennis Perone.
And it was truly the only place where you could learn about many of those subjects. I mean, it just wasn't getting covered elsewhere. And then that brings me to another question, which is kind of tied into some other things you were talking about. You know, this question of, is it even good to talk about these things? Is it better to remain silent and keep it all hidden? And one of the criticisms that R. Gordon Wasson has received is that by bringing international attention to the Mazatec psilocybin-containing mushroom ceremonies, he could have interfered with their culture or brought in a lot of outsiders, both of which are true for better or worse, and that a result of this interest in both psilocybin-containing mushrooms and ayahuasca and the Phylomedusa bicolor is that a tourist industry has emerged in many of these locations. What are your thoughts on that?
I'm just guilty. Yeah, I'm just guilty. Yes, and I wrestle with it. I didn't realize I was going to let the genie out of the bag with a couple of these things to such a large extent by writing about them. But I'm a journalist, and my instinct is to put it on paper and publish it. Be honest about it and get it out there. But that there are now thousands of people using the Phylomedusa bicolor, tens of thousands, who knows, hundreds of thousands, you know what I mean? Is that going to kill the frog off? Is that completely change how the indigenous live? Because now they get, relatively speaking, they got a lot more money than they would, you know, killing a wild boar and skinning it and bring it to sell somewhere for $5. They get a lot more than that just to collect a frog or two or 10. So Wasson, I mean, he brought this stuff out, and I think it's part of, I mean, the justification is it's part of the human history that these things occur. And yes, at the same time, it's part of a human tragedy that these things bring changes that are frequently unwanted, frequently horrible. But by the time you see what those changes are, it's too late. They've already been made. You know, people took over and the final Medusa bicolor from Peter Gorman, and they're now late and claim that they were the first, and that it's combo, it's not sapo, and it's this and that. And it's gotten an aura around it of this pseudo spirituality that we Westerners tend to put on anything that we like. You know, let's make it a spiritual thing. Ah, yeah. So I was doing the spirit of the frog, and frogs told me, shut up. Frog does not have the same vocal cords you do. If you could talk to it quietly, if you could meet it on a different plane, yeah, I believe it would communicate with you. But it didn't talk to you and say, stop arguing with your mother. That was the medicine unlocking the part that you and your mother hate each other. And you may be realizing that part of that is due to your fault. So you should stop hating your mother. So yeah, the frog gave it to you, but it didn't give it to you the way that you want to, you know, put pseudo religiosity on the whole thing.
Right. I mean, one thing that I struggle with is a lot of these objections do not come from the indigenous groups themselves, in my experience. And there's complicated reasons you could read into that, but the reality of my experience with San Pedro shamanism in Peru, or the Sapo in the Amazon with the Matses, or Mazatec psilocybin, or Gabonese Iboga rituals, is that really in all of these instances, what I detected more than anything was pride in the tradition and a certain excitement to share what they had, in the same way that you might be excited to share something amazing from your life with somebody from another culture. You might say, look at this great thing that's part of my life. I go, and this is a type of music that I listen to, and you might enjoy it because it's a big part of what I do, or this is a type of art that's important to me. That what I detect more than anything cross-culturally is a certain pride that people from around the world love what they are doing. Now, it's complicated, of course, because money is wrapped up in this equation. It is a source of enormous amounts of money for all of these groups. And so I don't really know how to read into it, but I get a little worried when I see outsiders speaking for these groups, talking about, you know, what is or is not right for them, when my experience with all of them, maybe with the exception of the Native American Church, which does not have any, for both legal and cultural and religious reasons, does not have any kind of provision for outsiders to become part of their ceremonies. But with that exception, it seems that it's often the case that there's a certain openness and pride in the traditions, and that they often invite interest from outsiders. Has that been your experience as well?
Yeah. I mean, I'm particularly Native American Church, and my old teacher, Bertha Grove, and her brother, Everett, and her son, Junior, the two were roadmen, which meant they ran ceremonies. And she was the medicine woman of the Southern Utes out of Four Corners near Durango. And what an amazing, amazing woman she was. Now, personally, I have one point of pride in which, you know, you try to go in and you try to walk lightly. You know, yeah, when you go in, they expect you to bring your knives, forks, a couple of machetes, maybe some shotgun shells. Once every 5 years, a shotgun. You know, I mean, otherwise they don't want you there, you know? You can't just go to somebody's house and eat up their supplies and then, you know, expect them to keep inviting you back for another night.
Right.
What's your job? So when I collected plants for Shaman Pharmaceutical in 93 and 94,
And what is that briefly? Could you just tell me what that is?
Shaman Pharmaceutical was a pharmaceutical company with a new concept of investigating medicines from the plant world. The concept was this. Whereas the American Cancer Society would simply collect any plant, if you were going for a master's or PhD, bring us back 300 plants and we give you $25 each. And they would look at all of them for any bioactivity or any, you know, particular activity in it that might be of interest. So it's totally hit or miss. Shaman Pharmaceutical, which had Richard Schultes at its head, decided to try something else. They said, no, we don't have the money to spend, you know, $1 billion, you know, investigating 10 plants or investigating 200,000 plants. What we want to do was we want the curanderos. We'll show curanderos physical illnesses at the very worst stages, funguses and cold sores when people have like lots and lots of them and, you know, that sort of thing, open sores. And the thing was, we'll send investigators out to different parts of Central and South America. And we won't look at any plant seriously unless four separate groups are using the same or a similar plant in a similar manner to treat the identical disease. So in other words, my job was to go. So it was a brilliant concept. The second part of the concept that they were doing was that they knew it was going to take 15 or 20 years to bring a plant to the market as a medicine. And they knew that the people who collected the medicine were not going to get their fair shake if they waited 20 years. They'd be dead or, you know what I mean? People wouldn't have a record of who the kids are and or the kids had scattered or whatever. So they said, Peter, when you go out, we like to give something back quickly. So find out what these people that you collect from want, and we will do our best to get it. And naturally, when I asked Pablo what he wants, he wanted a Rolls Royce. He wanted a blonde wife. He shows me a picture of Marilyn Monroe that he's got, you know, with her butt sticking up like that. That's what he... Melanino. So he wanted a car to drive her around with in the Amazon. So instead, I came back and said, what they want is they want their territory fully demarked in a forever sort of capacity, as best you can do that in South America. And they want all land, water, air, and mineral rights to that land so that tree cutters can't come in there and say, well, you might own the land, but we own the trees. We have this, you know, okay from the government. And, you know, Shaman spent, in 97, the Matses, as a group, were presented with 1 million acres of land. And everybody who was working there prior to that was kicked out. And I took a lot of stuff from a lot of people in Iquitos for ruining their livelihoods because they had just been taking advantage of the indigenous. So, you know, now they're not allowed to. Oh boy, that stinks. So, and this goes to the point of, you know, you mean well, you're trying to do good. And so I thought, good, I've finally done something so good that, you know, this clears up any karma I have of bringing out Sapo and getting too many other people interested in it. But of course, the Matses now are allowed to sell or give away any of those elements because they own them all. And so, of course, there are some Matses who now have gone to high school or college. They've been to Lima. They've even been to Mexico, maybe. And they come back saying, huh, so you guys got to make me chief. And then as chief, you got the right to sell off, you know, allow 20 fishermen in, allow 3 oil companies in, et cetera. So they could still screw themselves. But I thought it was better than them being screwed overall. And I really didn't believe that a Cadillac and Marilyn Monroe was going to make the Launch Kids happy.
Huh. Well, it might have.
It might have made Pablo happy, but I don't know if the rest of the Marseillais would have felt the same thrill.
Yes, that's a potential issue. And so this is all work you were doing quite a while ago, but you've been going back to the Amazon your entire life. And I'm under the impression that you even got some kind of a terrible infection years ago. Could you tell me a little bit about what happened?
Well, you want the truth or you want me to tell you a good story?
Maybe both.
The truth is that brujeria, negative energy, is a fact of life in places like, well, like everywhere in the world, but particularly in places like Peru, where there's not a lot of interference because it's spread out, you know? In Lima, it's harder. When you think good thoughts about someone, those thoughts have some sort of, in my world, a little bit of energy. So you keep thinking good, 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 and you bring other people in, like, let's just pray for this person, pray for this. I don't care what prayers you're using. I'm not saying be religious. I'm saying sing to the person, dance to the person, imagine the person well. And if 10 of you do it for 100 days, maybe it helps them get well. Or maybe subconsciously it gives them the strength to do what they need to do to help themselves get well. Okay. Now, that's for positivity. I believe negativity operates the same way. Negativity, if someone's thinking, you know, twist your ankle, twist your ankle, twist your ankle for a week, or someone pays them, you know, to twist your ankle, you know, mantra on that for a month and a half. Yeah, at some point, something's going to happen. Maybe twist your knee, but I mean, you can't have that much negativity coming in without being affected by it, okay? So, because there's a river town that you stop in on the way to where we're going to do, you know, our Peter Gorman jaunt, and that river town is home to 7 or 8 curanderos, healers. They all work with ayahuasca, some work with other plants, some also work with tobacco or eggs, you know, and all of them are pretty good healers. I mean, they've got more than a knack. I mean, it's like they really do know the plants. They know tons of stuff about the jungle. When they see me, they always see a Peter Gorman who has clients. So that means Peter Gorman has money. And that makes them, some of them, think, I haven't worked in 6 months. Why does he work with so-and-so? I'm a better curandero. He should work with me. And that touch of envy is a negative thought. Well, two things. One, most of the tours I ever took out broke even. I got to work a vacation out of it, maybe $500 or $1,000 when I got home. A few tours made me a good deal of money, and some tours lost me as much as $10,000. So, which in my world is about the limit of where savings are allowed to go before God takes them away. So these fellas, if they start talking to each other, if they start drinking agua de diente, you know, hard cane liquor, it really comes up pretty quickly. Like, you see Gorman today? How many people he had? And maybe, I don't know, 6, but including my team, it was 13, and they're drunk, and so they're seeing 13 gringos, and they're, how much money, blah, 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 and they're not making any money, but he is, and Gorman's not even giving us any money, like a couple $100 each, you know, to say, I'm sorry, I don't have room for you to work. And they start thinking negative things. So, some years ago, I'd gotten into the town with my guests, probably 3 in the morning, 2:33. And we'd already called up ahead, or radioed ahead at that time, to a person who had his tiny little restaurant. And so we said, you know, put out a big table and you know, be open and have good chicken soup and hot coffee ready at, 3:30 in the morning. We'll be in there somewhere around there. And so these people had to walk from the boat to a pitch black town, a couple of blocks. They were terrified. I later found out that they thought I was going to kill them or have them killed. And then they turn a corner and they turn one more corner and boom, there's 20 candles on a table, and there's coffee cups and, suddenly they're like, oh my God, you arranged it? How the hell do you arrange this? Like, yeah. So on this particular night, it was at a particular point where a bunch of particular people had been kind of working negative juju on me. And where this little restaurant table was located, it was just a table, it was in a little alley, pardon me, that opened onto a place where you buy fish or market, where you buy fish and fruits in the morning. And that door at the end of the alley would open up around 5:00. Okay, so I had my shorts on, and I was desperate to pee. Unfortunately, I had 3 or 4 of my guests still had not gone to a small hotel that I'd rented for them. They insisted on sitting up and talking all night. And so I couldn't just pee where I was. I would have just turned around and peed on the wall. Sorry, maybe that's TMI. So I had to wait till those doors opened. And then I raced across the rear courtyard of the market to where I knew there were 2 bathrooms. But I was in such haste that I did not pay attention. And as I walked through a section, the men were clearing the tables of yesterday's fish. They'd already been cleaned yesterday in the afternoon, but whatever was left, all that fetid stuff that was now truly poisonous, they were using Clorox and soap on it and scrubbing it down and, clearing off these stone tabletops, the cement tabletops, so that new fish could be brought in an hour. And all that stuff gets put in the back corner by the bathrooms. So I wasn't paying attention because I was too, I gotta go. And I walked about halfway through what I realized was the puddle. And suddenly there was a rope strung across the thing. It was not physical rope, but it was, an emotional rope. Caught me in the neck. My legs went up perfectly flat with my upper body. It was a planche. Like, if I could have done that in high school, I'd have won awards for gym class. But it also meant I was falling down quickly. And as I'm falling, I thought, oh, shit, something bad just happened. Something really bad. Because I'm familiar enough with when bad stuff happens. And, of course, I landed. I banged my head. And I couldn't get out of the fish guts and soap until somebody with a long 20-foot pole that was used to clean the ceiling every morning, or dust the ceiling every morning, came over and gave me, put the pole in there. I grabbed it and he pulled me out of the sludge. And I just slid along the ground. Now, the thing was, there was no soap around and there was no water around. All the water had been used for the coffee and had been used for the soup. So I had nothing to wash. My clothes had already gone up the river with the goods boat. You know what I mean? I had nothing to change into. I really didn't have any. So I basically just wiped the back of my legs and, where most of the goop was, in the back of my hair. And I didn't think about it. About 3 days later, I began having these little red streaks that began connecting to each other. So it looked like little serpents all over my lower legs. And what it turned out was, of course, it became gangrene. Within about a month, it was a flesh-eating bacteria combination. And it just, it just ate my right foreleg. I mean, it's, what I can tell you is it just ate. We don't have a lot of muscle in the front of that thing. And I guess I'd gotten the infection because I'd already been bitten hundreds of times on that trip by mosquitoes or spiders on my legs, right? And the ones I didn't see to put cream on were all over the back of my legs, which is where I sat in that goop for a while. And that, I didn't think about it, except that it began to itch crazily. Then it began to go wild. Then the colorations were so crazy, I started taking doxycycline that I had in my kit, which normally you wouldn't do it, but something bad happened. It was time for that. And I finished the trip. My leg was open, open, open. I mean, it was just, pus was coming everywhere over 6 by 12 inch piece of, you could see the bone.
Oh my God.
I mean, it was just down to the bone. It was, you couldn't like see the bone, like a cartoon version of that. But, you know, when you look close, you're like, oh my goodness, that's all the way through. Well, I ended up coming back to the States. I tried to clear it up in Iquitos with a pretty good couple of doctors, and they got most of it. They missed one of the bacteria, and they missed Pseudomonas. Pseudomonas is a wonderful bacteria that you have in your gut, among other places, that helps, you know, break down the foods, right? And so the food, then the power of the food can be released into your body. Well, Pseudomonas, when it gets outside your body, it's still just as hungry, and it breaks down whatever it's on. So it happened to be on my leg. It just started breaking that down. And it was monumental. It was kind of, in its own way, it was a little bit life-changing because it affected the way I thought I was invincible. Not like a superhero, but I had just tempted fate so many times. I was a decent athlete. I some of the things I'd done, people would have thought were nuts. That does not mean I did anything as good as or as tough as the real tough people do. No, I was not in that league at all. But this was one of those like, oh, these guys thought negative thoughts about me and they're taking my leg off. I really didn't like it going there. So I got back to the States and I showed 4 pictures to my doc in Alabama, several states away. And Gritter wrote back, put the coffee down, put your cigarette down, drive to the emergency room and see if they can't try to save that leg. And so, oh, I mean, 12 hours after I got there, I had the first of 2 operations for debridement. And the pictures were so howlingly elation. I mean, you just can't believe. Like, and then, but by luck, it had not gotten through the bone. So I was allowed to keep my leg. And that's the story of that one. I mean, it came back again. A couple of years later, but we knew the medicines that it needed right away. And so we managed to keep it on the outside. So it grew out of the skin rather than in. So my legs really look horrible now. I mean, they're disgusting. But you know, but they work, or they sort of work. And I mean, oh, when are you going to play in the Amazon sooner or later? There are things that are going to happen. You get bitten by certain spiders or poisonous snakes and malaria, dengue fever. You're going to get all of that if you insist on being an amateur and treading, you know, on holy ground. All these insects and snakes and bugs are there to keep you out. And so you insist because you want to keep me out, I want to go in and find out the secret. What do you got hiding in there? And that's my curiosity. But eventually, I mean, I paid a good price for that curiosity. You know, I've been really deathly ill. Emergency room, when it come home, just go straight to, you know, ICU several times, you know. And each time you're in the ICU, I might feel like I'm okay, just sick. They're like, you know, you might die tonight. You're like, thank you. You're telling my ex-wife that? You're telling my kids that? And it's like, of course. Like, well, just tell them I'll be fine. So.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I remember I was in Congo for the DRC with a guy who was a veteran of trips to Central Africa. He'd been who knows how many times. And I think for a lot of people, you get this feeling like, well, if you have access to Western medicine, you've got a little bit of money, you're invincible. Whatever happens to you can be treated as long as you can get yourself to a hospital. And I remember shortly after our trip together, he died of malaria. And that was really a shocking reminder of how dangerous these expeditions can be. And that if you think that just because you've got enough money to go to an emergency room, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're invincible.
Well, and what about, I mean, to me, the most clear example of that is that crazy Steve animal guy.
Yeah.
I'm forgetting his last name. I apologize.
Irwin?
Yeah, Steve Irwin. You know, this guy is playing with dangerous animals and he's got them doubled over laughing all the time. And then one time he gets a spike and then he's dead. It's like, holy shit, you're not invincible, Steve. You know, I'm not invincible. The next guy's not invincible. I am deathly afraid every time I take a group out to the jungle. I'm absolutely terrified that something bad's going to go on. And my prayer, standard prayer has been, look, God, if we have to pay a price and something bad has to happen to somebody, let it come to me. Because these people are just on vacation. I mean, they want a tough vacation, but they're still on vacation. So bring it to me. I know what might happen and I'll deal with it. And the jungle and God being very, very willing to go along with my wishes said, okay, you get it every time. And I don't think my people ever get sick even. I get it all the time. So my daughter said, Dad, you got to change that prayer to, hey, God, if something horrible doesn't have to happen, then please keep it from happening to them and me. It's like, I'm sorry, I never thought of it to pray that way. That would be cool.
And so you're going on another expedition. What do you hope to find on this newest expedition that you haven't found so far?
Okay. Now, can I put a plug in here?
Sure, yeah.
Are people get ready to get turned on? This is a little electricity. Huh. If you go to, on the web, the Gorman Expeditions.com, a GoFundMe page will come up, and it explains the trip. Basically, I did two trips all over from Iquitos up the Yabari, the border between Brazil and Peru, in 93 and 94, while I was plant collecting for a shaman. And it's now 28 years later. I've really been beaten up the last year and a half, 2 years, just horribly. And I can't just take gringos out into the jungle right now, you know? But I could do a great, you know, one of the expeditions I've been waiting to do for a long time, which is let's redo that trip. I've got the notebooks, you know, 300-400 pages each, 200 pages each, from the first two trips. Let's go back over. Let's go visit the river. Let's see, number one, what kind of changes have happened to the people on that river? For all I know, there's discotheques up and down, you know, where it used to be silent. I doubt it, but, it could be. The villages, I knew every village on that river was up and down 600-700 miles. How many of them have moved? And if they moved, have they moved just a little bit? Or have drug runners forced them into completely different areas? Secondly, I've got two research institutes asked me for plant collecting. And then thirdly, any expedition simply crosses its fingers and says, please show me something super cool that I've never heard about. Now, if you keep your ears and eyes open and you're in a place that's a hinterland, those people still live with stories. They've got stories of 50-foot boas and, you know, stories of 20-foot birds. And okay, some of those stories might be what they saw when they were terrified of an 8-foot or 25-foot anaconda, not 60-foot. But it looked like 60 feet because they were terrified. But then there were things like the frog happened. And by paying attention, I was lucky enough to bring it out with all the good effects later and the bad effects as well. But I mean, you know, that's the sort of thing. Maybe there's something waiting to give it to me now. Now, the other thing that allows this trip to go on is two of my good friends, Devin Wright and Matt Haddock, have really, they pushed me to do my end of it, which was writing and coming up with, you know, how much it's going to cost and what each element's going to cost and what kind of scientists we need to bring and et cetera, et cetera. But they kept the juice going to make the damn thing happen. Now, we're not there yet, so I don't know if it's going to happen. But we're in a few thousand dollars of getting a matching grant that's, you know, a considerable $30,000 grant. So any of your reading listeners out there, go to the GormanExpeditions.com and read. It's an interesting, but it's kind of a long sell. I don't want to make it a long sell. Take a look at it. We tried to keep the page entertaining. There's some cool photos of the boat that Matthew rented last month for the trip. And it's a sort of trip that even if I'm not in the best physical shape of my life anymore, because I'm not 35, I can do it. It's on a boat. You know, when you get to the villages, you get out of the boat, you got to climb up to the hill to where the village is, and you got to explain to people what you need to collect and what not collecting. But since we're not looking for specific medicinal plants, my team can go out and collect the plants, and I'll press them later until they get familiar with pressing to do it properly so that it'll be a wonderful specimen that could be identified, you know, back of the herbariums. And that, you know, that's coming up in January 6th, and we are very, very close to, you know, to sealing the deal. And we've already invested a whole bunch of, actually Matthew has invested a bunch of his own money to get a few things rolling, like getting the boat rented. So that's a trip that's coming up. And if I could do one more plug.
Of course.
People might know that I've got a couple of books out, one on ayahuasca and one on Tsavo. I just came up with a new book, which is a book of stories called Magic Mushrooms in India and Other Fantastic Tales. And so there's a few stories from India, one from Morocco, five or six from New York City, three from the Amazon, four from the Amazon maybe. Not a big, great 5-pound book. It's a light book. You can put it in your pocket. You know, it won't weigh you down. You could buy 20 copies for presents on Christmas, and you could still be able to carry the box with those 20 in them to the party. So that'd be my recommendation. Just go to Amazon.com or go to a bookstore and say, can you order me a, and they'll order you a copy, and it'll be coming in a couple of days. It's a funny book. Stories cover a period of about 12 or 15 years. Just a good read. You're stuck inside with the pandemic. Stop watching TV. Read a book. Read 3 books.
Okay. Well, that sounds really good. And I really appreciate your time. It's a pleasure to talk to you and hear these stories.
Well, you know, you actually got me to tell a couple that I never told before. So thank you for, it probably wasn't much effort, But you said a different verb or a different noun. So I'm glad I was not just repeating the same stories. Must be like a rock person, you know, a rock star or just rock and roller. And they go to the, you know, they start to play some songs and everybody's like, no, play us the number one hit from 38 years ago. Like, I wouldn't play that enough, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, so, but thank you very much, Hamilton. I appreciate your time and your effort. And I, of course, Soren, he's my friend, and I appreciate Soren. And that's pretty much, I'm out of energy right now.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you.